Good morning, Connecticut, to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquet, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning Public Affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're going to open paying a visit to the Valley Community Foundation, serving a cluster of communities in the Lower Niagara Valley region, to talk about the Valley Gives Back Initiative, which is working to build philanthropy in the Valley and to get people thinking about simple ways they can remember their community while supporting their favorite charitable organization. Then we're going to ring up an epidemiologist from the Connecticut Department of Health who's trying to educate and engage employers who may have members of their own workforce suffering with an opioid addiction. This year, state health officials have already hosted two symposiums on the subject, and they're looking to engage more employers as the agency begins to work developing a model substance abuse program for Connecticut employers. And did you know that Homefront is looking for residents in need of home repairs for its upcoming 31st annual repair blitz in the spring of 2018? We're going to close talking with the agency's director about how this program can help with faulty windows, doors, steps, railings, leaky roofs, plumbing, even electrical needs at no cost to qualifying low-income homeowners as long as they apply or somebody applies for them by November 17th. We're going to be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquet, right after this reminder. Well, speaking of the Valley, coming up on October 24th, it's the Oxford High School Stuff the Bus campaign to help Spooner House, building hope and renewing lives in the Valley. Public drop-off is happening at Oxford High School between 9:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m., and Spooner House is asking for gluten-free items, frozen turkeys or monetary donations, stuffing mix, instant potatoes, gravy, evaporated milk, cranberry sauce, cornbread, all the stuff you need to make a fantastic holiday dinner for a family. If you have any questions, you can contact the organizer at 203-888-2468 at Oxford High School, or just come out between 9:30 and 12:30 on October 24th. Bring your food donations and help Oxford High School stuff a bus.
Well, we are in the Naugatuck Valley today and visiting with someone whose voice I know well from the phone. As a matter of fact, we were just chatting with Sharon Clocius that I think she was the very first media interview she gave after weeks, maybe days after she was hired to the Valley Community Foundation as president and CEO. She chatted with us on the award-winning For the People. And now we're visiting her beautiful house here in downtown Derby. And as we're chatting before we turned on the microphone, Sharon was saying how folks are inundated on the web, on their social sites, on TV, on radio, and newspapers with the brands of many large statewide, national, even global nonprofit charities. But there are so many other thousands and thousands of grassroots and small boutique charities that are doing so much good in their own communities, dozens, if not hundreds, here in the Naugatuck Valley. So we're here to talk about how the Community Foundation is working to try to be a worthy pass-through and to educate folks on how they can keep their spirit of giving and philanthropy going for the betterment of their own communities here in the Naugatuck Valley. So, Sharon, great to be here with you. Thanks for having me. First of all, let's refresh people's memory about the Valley Community Foundation, still a sort of a partner with the Greater New Haven organization.
Yes, we're an affiliate of the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven. They support us with their back office, our back office needs, mm-hmm. as well as our grant-making process. They really are a source for us with regard to doing good, great due diligence for our fund holders.
And certainly, as they've been guests on our program going all the way back 28 years and beyond when I started, doing really incredible work, innovative thinking, out-of-the-box thinking about how to get people to both realize and take matters into their own hands to continue to do good in their communities.
Yes, absolutely. I think when you meet with the people at the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven, they do have that intuition of the bigger picture of what really needs to happen in the communities at large. Mm.
So what communities does the Valley Foundation serve?
We serve Ansonia, Derby, Seymour, Oxford, and Shelton.
Okay. So are your goals here in the Valley similar to what the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven is? In other words, do you espouse their goals, or does the geography and demographic makeup of the communities you serve give you reason to tweak those mission points?
God, that's a great question. We are, we basically like to say that we're doing the work of the Community Foundation out here in the Valley. That when I'm going to say the Community Foundation, I'm going to refer to it as TCF, so sure. that we can differentiate between the two.
Yeah.
But TCF has a number of large preference funds, what we call field of interest funds, that their donors set up years ago to benefit here, to benefit in the Valley, the Naugatuck area. And so what happens is that we work with the Community Foundation for Greater New Haven and bring those dollars out here. So we strategically look at what is the need here in the Valley, and we, you know, put together our plan and how we want to best fit the needs here in the Greater Valley area to meet those needs.
Yeah. And certainly from a geographic and potential fundraising points, there are a whole different scale here in the Valley. The Community Foundation of Greater New Haven has some massive corporate entities that they work with in a much more kind of far-flung area, where the Valley certainly has some different challenges in terms of the amount of funds you could depend on from large corporate givers, because the Valley and many riverside communities throughout New England that used to be thriving manufacturing bases have in great part lost those philanthropic business partners.
Yes, that's very true. But most community foundations, really at their core, is made up of donations from individuals.
Oh, okay.
And so many of our funds, both our funds and TCF's funds, are made up with donations that people have left in their bequests, left in their wills, or they are, you know, working together right now with us in giving us, you know, contributions to be able to do certain good.
Hmm. And that being said, if you look at an organization like a volunteer fire company or an ambulance service, you know, they touch a lot of people in the community where, you know, when they put out a fund appeal, they're hitting a lot of points of contact. It doesn't mean that much smaller nonprofits that are doing equal good for a much smaller population aren't also deserving. And I guess that's kind of the role you have to play, is helping to expose the greater giving community to these smaller organizations and the work they do.
Yeah, what happens with community foundations are. Work is to get the information out to both the nonprofits that we're here, and they do need to apply for grants. They mm-hmm. can't, we don't just go out and give money to nonprofits because they're doing worthy causes. Mm-hmm. They do apply, they do go through a process of due diligence. But we also get the word out to donors. You bring up a great example with volunteer fire departments. I had in my previous position with the Community Foundation, we had a fund. It was established from a firefighter who wanted to give back to his volunteer corps that he was with for so many years. So in his estate plan, he left, he did a charitable remainder trust, so he took care of his family first. Mm-hmm. And then the remainder went to, in this case, the Community Foundation, to benefit that volunteer fire department. And over the years, that fund grew to the point where one year they were actually, purchasing cameras, you know, those special cameras to see through. And then for a period of time, they actually stopped taking distributions until they could buy a fire truck. So, you know, there's so many things because, and that's not to twist the conversation over to the Valley Gives Back, but that's why it's important for us as a community to have that message to give local and to give back when you no longer need the assets. Because many people, you know, they don't know how long they're going to live. They don't know if they're going to need their assets till they're 95, 100 years old. So
you can't take it with you, but you could take it up to the day you cash in your ticket, right?
That's right, up to that very end. So they tend to give from their income. And they, you know, they know that that's what their income is. So they tend to give from their income. The message with the Valley Gives Back is we get it. We understand it. The nonprofits understand that. But when you're doing your planning or thinking about it, please remember and think about giving local. And you know, one of the challenges that some people think is that they got to give it all. And that's not the case at all.
The other thing that I think it's important from an educational standpoint, not just for the Valley Community Foundation, but for anyone, is that like we talk with our friends from the Connecticut Food Bank where they say it's wonderful to get a can of soup because that can of soup will help a family get through a meal. But if you give a dollar, they have the means to buy $5 or $6 or $8 worth of food and, you know, essentially teach a person to fish versus give them a fish. It's a similar kind of situation when people partner with the Valley Community Foundation. The foundation has the power to help their sometimes modest investments, as you pointed out, like with the fire department, grow.
Absolutely. With a community foundation, we're able to invest those dollars and have those dollars grow and be able to do even more grant making over the years of those funds that are here. With the Valley Gives Back, what we're trying to do is actually leverage our knowledge as well. So, you know, a donor may want to give directly to an organization like the Boys and Girls Club or, you know, one of the food banks, one of the food pantries. And they may choose to come through the community foundation. But they may want to give it directly to that organization, but they want to ask us questions to know how to do it. And we want to play that service. We want to play the full service, whether they somebody wants to give to the organization directly or want to give to the community foundation to benefit their favorite charities. We just want to be able to share that message to help our nonprofits be able to look for those bequests. Because like you said, when you're opening remarks, they can't compete against some of those big national and international causes. And we hope to have billboards up. We hope to do mailings and advertisements just to remind the citizens in the Valley to remember to give local when they're doing their estate plan.
But not to single out Salvation Army, but when Salvation Army does a Super Bowl ad and they are able to parlay, you know, $1.5 million dollars for a 30-second ad, that $1.5 million, you could never spend. There are not enough billboards or, for that matter, radio commercial spots available for you to spend all that money in the impression area that you want to serve.
That's correct. And I'm going to tell you that one thing that is so wonderful about the Valley is that it is the Valley. It really, people identify with this area. Even when they move out, they know out of the area, they're still from the Valley. We have some fund holders base that graduated from Derby High School, and they wanted to give back when they all turned 40 years old, and they established a fund called the Valley Pride because they know they're proud of being from this area. And we have a lot of those residents you know, here, or they may be down in Florida right now. Mm-hmm. But we want to remind them of what the Valley meant to them, what it means to them now, and what they want it to mean to the future generations. Mm.
So in the last 4 or 5 minutes that we have with you, Sharon, and folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Sharon Klosius, President and CEO of the Valley Community Foundation. Their latest initiative is called Valley Gives Back. So tell folks a few of the most important things that they need to know about Valley Gives Back and how they might engage.
Well, the Valley Gives Back, the hub around the Valley Gives Back is actually its website. Mm-hmm. We have a website called valleygivesback.org that we would like people, nonprofits, individuals, and professional advisors to go out, take a look, get some ideas of what kind of things that you might want to do. Start to understand what the giving vehicles are, because people can do things as complicated as a trust, charitable lead trust, charitable remainder trust, all of that. But you know what they could also do? They could also just go into their bank and say, I want to change the beneficiary of my savings account to go to this organization. And with that, they all of a sudden are giving back. If they need that, those assets in that savings account, it's theirs. Because, again, getting back, they don't know how long they're going to live. Right, they don't know if they're going to need that money. Sure. So this way, they can actually do something that's not going to cost them attorney fees and all those other things. And they can just make somebody maximize and make somebody the beneficiary of one of their asset accounts. And not even all of it, maybe just 50% of it or 10% of it. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to direct people to the Valley Gives Back website and have people go out there and take a look and just get to know what kind of ways they could do things to give back.
And I guess one of the cool things about educating the communities that you serve with this initiative is we tend to talk about, moving toward the end of life. But as you pointed out, you had a bunch of 40-year-olds establishing a fund. But a 5-year-old with the equivalent of the money generated from a corner lemonade stand could begin a lifelong practice of philanthropy.
Absolutely. In fact, that's really a great point of making sure our children understand. We have the most generous generations in our, 60-year-olds and plus. They've just always seen examples of generosity, whether it's time or talent or treasure. You know, our grandparents and our grandparents' grandparents, they relied on one another and that community effort. And we need to make sure that our kids get that and our grandchildren get that.
Yeah. And the other incredible thing about Valley Gives Back, which anyone listening, wherever you are, even on our podcast on Maui or somewhere in Europe, listening online or on iTunes, if you go to valleygivesback.org, it's kind of a one-stop shop for information about charitable giving. Even if you're not giving in the Valley or you live in the Valley, the educational and orientation information is universal.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And one of the that was one of the key components is we wanted to make sure that it was a website that was factual, but at the same time, not so intellectual that you don't understand it.
Right.
We wanted to make sure that it was very clear in clear terms. There's illustrations out there, how everything works, calculators of, people to get ideas from. Yeah. And a lot of people like to do that in the privacy of their own home or their own office, on their own time. Yeah. Exactly.
And
exactly.
In their own time.
Yes.
Great. Well, we hope that this little orientation has given some inspiration to everyone from proprietors of the corner lemonade stand all the way up to some of our most wealthy and generous neighbors, both here in the Valley, around Connecticut, and anywhere you're listening. Very pleased to be here in the house of the the Valley Community Foundation in Derby, with Sharon Clocius, the president and CEO of the Valley Community Foundation, talking about Valley Gives Back. Once again, if you'd like to learn more about this initiative, whether you're here in one of the communities served by the Community Foundation in the Valley, or anywhere you may be listening to the program, you can learn a lot more about becoming a philanthropist at valleygivesback.org. Sharon, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've talked so much on this program about the opioid epidemic. Even before they were calling it the opioid epidemic, we were talking about intervention and the response to opioid addiction here on the award-winning For the People. But it's great to be brought into something of an impromptu partnership with Connecticut's Department of Public Health and to make the acquaintance of epidemiologist Deborah Peace, who was assisted in organizing two, and in fact, just earlier this month, the second of two sessions that brought together leaders from Connecticut's business, labor, insurance, and medical communities for this second symposium entitled The Opioid Crisis in Connecticut's Workforce. The symposium focused on the impact of the opioid crisis that it has on Connecticut's workforce. Shockingly, according to a survey conducted by the National Safety Council just earlier this year, more than 70%, 7 out of 10 employers have been impacted by prescription drug use, but only less than 2 out of 10 feel extremely prepared to deal with that issue. So in partnership with the Connecticut Department of Health and Deborah, we're going to try to utilize our program to bring more employers to the table to both get and give information ahead of a white paper that our guest Deborah is going to be working on in a very short time. So enough from me. Deborah, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us and making us a part of this initial effort.
Great. Thank you so much, John, for asking me to speak about this.
So let's give a quick look back. There were two sessions, one earlier this year and then one a couple of weeks ago. What was your hope going into these?
So it was more initially kind of a fact-finding mission, just learning more about opioid addiction and workers. In the spring of 2016, everywhere I had turned, there was another article in the news about the opioid epidemic. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, where do opioid-addicted individuals work, and how were they supporting themselves financially, and what impact were they having on the workplace? And it was these set of inquiries that became my inspiration for our first symposium, the Injured Worker and Opioid Use Symposium, that was held on March 1st of this year. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge success. Attendees compiled a wish list of next steps, and at the top of that list was a follow-up symposium about the issues facing employers.
So so let's get a little bit of the backstory on this. As you were moving from the outcomes and successes of symposium number one and going into symposium number two, you know, what are a few of the things that that you learned to help make symposium number two better, and what are a few of the outcomes from that are going to help you accomplish your future work in developing what could end up becoming a substance abuse model policy or program for Connecticut employers?
Oh, that's a great question. So some of the things that we had gathered from the first symposium was that there are other alternatives to using opioid medication for pain management. Pain management, what we learned in that first symposium, is a huge problem, not only in Connecticut, but in the United States. And so we've learned that in using other alternative treatments, you can potentially avoid a patient who could, you know, a patient who could potentially become addicted. So if you put them on a different track, and Adam Seidner had presented at that first symposium a matrix, a series of questions that kind of highlights high-risk groups, and then you just track them into another way of managing their pain. And that saved them thousands of dollars in doing that kind of metric. So from that concept, we were able to take a step forward and start thinking, okay, we know that people are injured in the workplace, and we want to focus on health and safety in order to prevent injuries, but what else can we be doing? There's more that we can be doing. So then we said, let's get Connecticut employers together and start talking about this issue, about what are the best practices that employers can use in order to implement policies and procedures that are going to successfully help the employer and help the worker who is addicted to an opioid or an addiction in general.
Mm-hmm. And so the bottom line is, I guess, that, you know, as we heard from these statistics, 70% or more of employers have been impacted by opioid or prescription drug use, but only less than 20% feel extremely prepared to deal with this issue. So this is a gap, a huge gap that you're eventually hoping to fill to some extent.
Absolutely. That is, it's a challenge. I mean, the opioid epidemic, there are a lot of factors that need to be considered, you know, in trying to effectively, you know, partner with people in order to work with groups and things. But the ignoring is, employers can't ignore it anymore. I just see that it's going to get, as time goes on, it's going to get more complicated, and there's going to be a lot more issues. As a matter of fact, an attorney, Monty Frank, had even mentioned at our most recent symposium that there's not a lot of case law in the federal courts or in state courts about opioid addiction, but that he's anticipating that's going to change over time, and that opioids are going to become more and more prevalent in the workplace. And it's not to say, you know, that it's not prevalent now. It's just, it may be hidden. And so understanding and knowing, you know, what an opioid addiction is, know what the symptoms are, things like that, I think employers can arm themselves in helping their employee get the treatment and have a positive outcome with compassion. And then hopefully, you know, with their partnerships, internally, they can develop programs like peer-to-peer programs and things like that within their program. And that's kind of what we're getting at as best practices. But that was one of the best practices that were presented at the symposium about partnerships and getting your employees to help on that peer-to-peer support program.
Well, it seems like either anecdotally or through applied research into this, Deb, you seem to be pretty aware that workplaces that can as much accommodate an individual with a physical disability or a behavioral disability and still have a very cohesive, creative, and successful workforce, there is a place for both the empathy and the acceptance for an individual who may be an opioid addict to be able to function within the framework of that workplace while receiving support to hopefully, as you even pointed out from the first symposium, find some alternatives to move them into a better place.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to take a few moments break here, and we're going to come back and talk more with Deb Pease of the Connecticut Department of Public Health. She's an epidemiologist with that state organization, and we're chatting on the heels of the second of two Connecticut Department of Health symposiums that was held earlier in October, called The Opioid Crisis and Connecticut's Workforce. Stick around, and we'll come back and talk more with Deb right after this break. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The STEM Advanced Manufacturing and Technology Expo is coming on Friday, November 3rd from 8 to 2 at the Technology Hall Atrium of Naugatuck Valley Community College in Waterbury. This event is free and open to middle and high school students, teachers, parents, and the public, and offers opportunities to interact with manufacturers and technology company executives to view exhibits and demonstrations highlighting the direct connections between STEM and manufacturing and technology careers. Need more information? Just hit waterburychamber.com. All right, we're back. Thanks for sticking with us. There are a lot of employers out there in Connecticut who may be aware that members of their workforce are or may be addicted to opioids. Many more who aren't. And our guest, Deb Pease from the Connecticut Department of Public Health, has some great concerns, worthy concerns, that employers really do need, if never before now, to begin to both understand the challenges and issues facing those employers and understand that they can play a role in both making sure that these employees continue to be or become exceedingly more contributing members of the workforce, but also maybe provide a avenue toward these individuals kicking that drug habit. So, Deb, my understanding was that one of the most important things you wanted to come out of from this Opioid Crisis in Connecticut's Workforce Symposium was eventually working on developing a model substance abuse program for Connecticut employers. But what you need to accomplish that successfully is for those employers to come forward and not just learn from the Connecticut Department of Health, but to talk to the Connecticut Department of Health.
Absolutely. We are in the process of outlining and crafting a white paper that we are hopeful to disseminate in the next, say, 3 to 6 months. But we need Connecticut employers to contact us and to inform us of different practices and things that they're concerned with, stories, et cetera. If we could find, a handful of Connecticut business leaders that are interested in this topic and are very passionate, we would love to hear from them. A CEO champion maybe has a backstory and could kind of lead the way here in Connecticut would be fabulous. And critical to getting employers to actually implement our white paper and hopefully help individuals who have an opioid addiction or another addiction to seek the treatment that they need.
You know, even 5 years ago, never mind 20 or 30 years ago, for an employee or a company principal to stand up in any public arena and say that at one time they were an addict was, kind of like a career death sentence. But I think one of the hardest challenges for people like you and the Connecticut Department of Health is to kind of turn that corner to the point where that public health crisis is actually not just recognized, but acknowledged. You said it earlier before the break that people have to see this is an issue whose time has not only come, but has the potential to be worse. So let's talk a little bit about a few of the specifics, if you don't mind, from the October symposium and some things that specific things that employers may need to know to not only facilitate maybe a conversation with you to help with the white paper and the eventual substance abuse program you're trying to develop for Connecticut employers, but something maybe that they can even begin to think about and do right now.
Okay. What I would say is that Connecticut employers or even employees who want to learn more about addiction or opioids in the workplace should go to the Connecticut Clearinghouse. That's a website. They can find a lot of information on there about understanding drug abuse and addiction and ways to talk to a coworker or a supervisor and to not think that they're going to get them in trouble. Because I think people are concerned that they're going to, you know, someone's going to lose their job. But really, it's more than that. It's having enough heart and compassion to reach out to a fellow person, you know, worker, coworker, to help them get the treatment that they need. So I would say go to the Connecticut Clearinghouse. Another thing that they can do is they can look on our website, the Connecticut Department of Public Health, and just in the Google toolbar, type in opioids and workers, and on our website you'll get the first symposium. I'll probably next week or the week after start updating the presentations from the most recent symposium. But I do think employers need to think about EAP also. They need to think about EAPs and having systems in place so that if a worker does come to them with these issues in a crisis situation, they can act on it immediately.
Well, yeah, I think the most important thing that you're articulating to employers is whether they're an owner-operator that occasionally may bring on seasonal help or the occasional assistant, all the way up through small to large businesses and huge corporations and huge workforces under a single employer umbrella, is that the Connecticut Department of Health is very savvy and has a lot of information that's available to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as I had said earlier, this is not this is a huge issue, and we all need to collaborate. Our agency is working with the Department of Mental Health. We're working with the Department of Consumer Protection. We're all working together and doing bits and pieces of what's going to hopefully help Connecticut employers and Connecticut residents in avoiding, you know, the worst case scenario, a friend or relative, you know, what have you. Everyone is being affected by this, so we're just hoping to get as much of the information out there as possible.
Hmm. Now, from your expertise as an epidemiologist, can you, in the last few minutes that we have with you, sort of talk to folks that are listening this morning that may be business owners, small business employers, or decision makers in their company, and to just give them a little bit of an orientation and help them to understand how an opioid addiction affects an individual person and how, with the right support and alternatives, that person may not only be able to begin turning this addiction around, but also can continue to be a better and more productive employee. You know, if I was an employer coming to you
right,
saying, you know, what do I need to know about
yeah.
an employee?
So what I would say is that there are many faces of an opioid use, and that no one's immune to it. And that a prescription for pain medication or management can potentially lead someone to using an opioid long term and becoming addicted to that. And that's a prescription that was given to you by a physician. And we've been doing a lot of outreach here from this agency on that to educate physicians and people about these kind of drugs, and that there are other alternatives that they could be using for pain management. And that even with a 10-day supply of opioids, you know, 1 in 5 people become like long-term users.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with statistics like that, people really need to be careful and understand and know what they're taking. I've heard stories about, you know, people who just, you know, they did what their physician told them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Take this medication, and they didn't think anything of it. Or maybe somebody got some medicine from a family member or friend, which is a very common way for someone to get,
sure,
you know,
I'm
medicine.
Having this, oh, I just twisted my back.
Yeah, I twisted my back. Here you go.
Yeah.
Unknowingly, you just give them because you think you're helping them,
yeah.
But you don't know the history of that person, and that's really what people need to understand is that if you have an addictive personality,
mm-hmm.
or have had past trauma and things like that, it automatically predisposes you to potentially becoming an addict.
Cool.
And that's kind of with the matrix that I had mentioned about Adam and kind of thinking about that.
Okay. Well, before we let you go, let the folks that are listening know where they could go. I don't know if you've already got another symposium in the early stages of planning, but for individuals in the workplace who may want to come on board and offer their perspectives or ask questions, what's the best way for them to do that through the Connecticut Department of Public Health?
Absolutely. I work in the occupational health program here at the department, and you can send an email to me directly, Deborah, Deborah, Pease, that's Pease, at ct.gov. I will say this, that if they do want to keep it anonymous, that is fine. I understand that, you know, some of this information is very confidential, but we want to hear from people, and we can, you know, make sure that if we're going to cite things and do that, we'll keep that as, you know, confidential, but that, you know, these are employers or that have come to us with this information.
Excellent.
Because we're hoping to just, you know, we're hoping that other employers will benefit from it.
Very good. Peers helping peers, peer-to-peer in the business world here in Connecticut. According to the latest National Safety Council survey, which is fresh here in 2017, 7 out of 10 employers have been impacted by prescription drug use, but less than 2 in 10 feel extremely prepared to deal with the issue. Thanks to the Connecticut Department of Public Health and to you, Deb Pease, who has helped organize these two opioid workshops so far. The latest one, the opioid crisis in Connecticut's workforce, just earlier this month, and the plans to put out this white paper outlining a model substance abuse program for Connecticut employers. They can't do it without Connecticut employers and employees coming forward, telling their stories, asking their questions. So we would urge folks that are listening this morning that are in that position that want to both help themselves in their workforce as well as others during this opioid epidemic and into the future to be in touch with the Connecticut Department of Public Health to make this happen, and continue to consult their website to find out when the next symposium will be and perhaps attend and contribute. Deb Pease, thank you so much for your time this morning. Great information, and I hope we've done some good out there. All right. Well, we're going to close the program today with a great organization and a great individual who helps run it. Sean O'Brien's on the line with us. He's executive director of Homefront, which serves New Haven, Fairfield, Hartford, and Litchfield counties here in the state. Homefront's mission is to keep low-income neighbors in their homes with an improved quality of life through the completion of repairs at no cost to them. Since its founding, this is incredible. Homefront and its volunteers in the areas that we just covered have delivered more than $40 million in donations of products and services to local communities. We're here today because we want to talk about their upcoming 31st annual Repair Blitz, which is coming up in the spring of 2008. But like all good and important things, it's all about the planning. And so now is the time, if you're interested in getting involved as an individual, through your service group, through your employer, many opportunities to be involved. So, Sean, let's tell them all about it. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Oh, it's great, John. Thank you. It's our pleasure.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the program that we're promoting, let's talk a little bit more about Homefront. There are a couple of organizations out there that engage people in kind of community-centric efforts to help keep those who can't afford to or who are unable to aging in place and resilient in their own homes. Tell us mm-hmm. a little bit of the background on Homefront.
Absolutely, yeah. So there are a number of great organizations. Of course, the reality of Connecticut is that it's a beautiful place to live, but it can also be a challenging place to live if Plan A doesn't quite go as we all expected. So there's a need for quite a lot of resources out there. And we try and cover as much of the state of Connecticut as we can, wherever the need is greatest, so that we can help people to stay in their homes and have that continuity, you know, for older adults, as you said, to have the familiarity of living out their golden years in the communities they've known their whole lives. And for younger Connecticut residents, the connection between the stability of a home and their performance in academics, you know, more likely to graduate from schools and do better in school because they don't have to worry about that leak over their head. Mm. But we see ourselves as performing that role of the old-fashioned barn raisings, where communities were more in touch with the needs of those in their neighborhoods. And now we all lead very busy lives, and so we really see it as our responsibility to make the connections with people who do want to help a neighbor, and also connect with the families who have had some illnesses or job loss or maybe a retirement account that was decimated by the recession or adversity, that we play that intermediary role where we're really trying to direct the goodwill that is still alive and well in our state to the place where it's needed most.
Well, I've been fortunate enough to be able to see an encapsulated case study from knowing the individuals who were in trouble and needed help and who were literally facing having to leave their family home because the repairs and the need for them and the cost of them just got out of control over years and years, deferred maintenance through no fault of their own due to financial and health constraints. And then for them to have applied to Homefront, gotten the green light that the crew would be coming there to do the work, and then seeing that work get done and how it not only restored the home, but really restored the quality of life for these people.
It also restores their faith in humanity, because there are, unfortunately, so many negative stories out there. And hats off to you for helping to cover some of the more positive stories of people who are doing good in the community, and the difference that they're able to make with just even setting aside one day out of their very busy lives to transform a home and make a really concrete difference in a family's life. One of the things I've learned, John, is that there are no walls between us, all sort of in this together, and we really try to facilitate that as much as we can.
Mm. On the other hand, the other incredible potential of Homefront is a lot of times, for the very first time, engaging people in this sort of hands-on philanthropy of giving back. And I mean, it can start as young as like middle school and high school age for volunteers to come forward. It doesn't have to be a big kind of organized corporate effort, or an entire church comes out, church community members come out. You know, it can be individuals all coming together for a single cause. Can you talk a little bit about the process of getting registered, because as we indicated, up until November 17th is the application period for being considered for help for the 2018 season. But people can come to Homefront up until the early spring of next year if they want to be part of the helping contingent, right?
That's absolutely right, John. And what we're looking for this time of year is on two tracks. For any of your listeners who may encounter a family in need, they can point them to our website, which is homefrontprogram.org. And we're also looking for those who might be able to help roll up their sleeves and help a family in need. And most of what we do is through groups of volunteers. So for those who belong to a faith community or a civic group or may want to get their business involved, we'd really love to be able to say yes to more of these families who are coming to us in need. And one of the things I always feel is incredibly important as we head into our 31st year of doing this, is the importance of confidentiality. Anyone who applies to us, their information is strictly between them and our office. So we're very, we take that very seriously. And in terms of the dignity, of the family asking us for help, all of that is protected in our office. But people can call us to get answers to questions at our toll-free number, which is 800-887-4673. Again, it's 800-887-4673. And talk to one of us, a live person, about a family they may know of in need of help, or a group that may be interested in volunteering with us in the spring.
And that's a really important point, Sean, because, you know, like anybody, you know, nobody likes to ask for help. Nobody likes to put themselves out there. And so many folks who are in the position to need help come from that time in that generation where it was not done. They are always thinking there's other people who need the help more. So I don't think it could be stressed enough that there are these are not just volunteers whose hearts are in the right place, who come to this effort from a church community or a business or a social organization or a scout troop, but there are industry experts, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, hundreds of them right here in Connecticut who take great pride in participating in these programs. There are younger apprentices through the trade schools and things. There are a lot of folks who are literally waiting and looking forward to coming out and helping these people.
I couldn't have put that better myself. You know, we have the graying of America, and certainly the graying of Connecticut as well, particularly with
the greatest generation now aging out. And you're right, it really is giving a gift to the volunteers who are able to help by opening up your home to them. And our program is in charge of making sure that everything is done incredibly smoothly and everything that started is finished, and to be the intermediary there. But so many of these folks, John, they're all people who have given of themselves at different stages of their lives, and now they could use a helping hand. And there are volunteers out there who want to have that good feeling of giving back and making a difference right in their backyard. Mm-hmm. To, as we're seeing more and more, volunteers coming from those who've been helped before.
Right, exactly.
The younger families that we help, where they put on a T-shirt and work with a volunteer group to help someone else in need in the year to come.
Yeah, they want to pay it forward. So if on behalf of someone you know needs help, or if you need help yourself, please know that there are people out there, many hundreds of them, that want to pay forward good deeds that were done for them, and you can give them that opportunity. Homefront offers help with faulty windows, doors, steps, railings, leaky roofs, painting, plumbing, electrical service, all at no cost to qualifying low-income homeowners. And the date to file for this assistance is November 17th. It's coming up quicker than you think. So you want to call 800-887-4673 or go to homefrontprogram.org to learn more. Homefront's mission is keeping low-income neighbors in their homes with an improved quality of life through the completion of repairs at no cost. 30 years, 3,000 neighbors helped, more than $40 million in donations, and it's time to step up for 2018. So get in touch at homefrontprogram.org. Our guest, Sean O'Brien, is Executive Director for Homefront here, serving Fairfield, Hartford, New Haven, and Litchfield counties in Connecticut. Sean, thank you again so much for taking some time to talk with us this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.